This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
We have two big picture time pressures that really mean we should be acting a lot more urgently than most of us have. And one of them is peak oil or energy collapse, and one of them is climate change or runaway global warming.
I think that most people, even most scientists, continue to underestimate how far down the path to climate catastrophe we've already traveled.
For the most part, we're oblivious to it. We don't want to know about it. We don't want to hear about it.
The one thing I'm most afraid of is that we're going to mount a tremendous campaign to sustain the unsustainable.
At this point, the scientists are saying that the Earth's temperature may increase by as much as 10 degrees. At that point, there may not even be bacteria left.
When the oil starts to really run dry, and when those in power have to assert their power in a time of dwindling resources, I think they're going to turn to much more blunt and cruel methods of enforcing their power.
The whole climate is changing. The winds, the ocean currents, the storm patterns, snowpack, snowmelt, flooding, droughts.
It's stunning how fast the destruction is proceeding.
Every day that passes, the world is in worse shape.
The sad-looking man you see on the screen is Derek Jensen. Jensen is the best-selling author of several non-fiction books, including A Language Older Than Words and A Culture of Make-Believe. His books deal with topics such as surveillance, child abuse, the environment, and something he calls civilization.
The friendly voice you just heard is Franklin Lopez. He created a video argument for ending civilization. Kick it over before we kill again. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with an in-depth look at the works of Deep Green writer Derek Jensen, an interview with filmmaker Lopez, and a series of ugly questions for Impossible Times. You just heard a clip from the new movie End Civ by Franklin Lopez. He was raised in the Puerto Rican independence movement. In New York, Lopez was a cameraman producer for the Amy Goodman, Juan Gonzalez alternative news program, Democracy Now! As The Stimulator, Frank gets millions of views for his regular video podcast, It's the End of the World as We Know It, and I Feel Fine.
This episode of It's the End of the World as We Know It and I Feel Fine was made possible by contributions from slaves like you. Spanky very much.
1929. It'll get worse now because it'll go faster. Money markets will dry up round the world by the end of the week. ATMs will stop spitting bills.
Patriotic slam by bright light feeling pretty sight.
Yeah, that's REM, the Canadian group. It's the end of the world as we know it, and we feel fine. Lopez went to the latest Republican and Democratic conventions, plus the Cancun Climate Summit, to film the street action, to get the outside story in. He brings us activism and voices that never make the mainstream news. There is a lot of irreverent, foul-mouthed fun in some of Lopez's productions, but in today's program, you'll hear a very serious side. For the past many years, Lopez filmed his own video interviews with hundreds of authors and activists, many you might know, like James Howard Kunstler, but Lopez takes care to find alternative voices from the streets and the woods, women, youth, Aboriginal people, the homeless, the excluded. NCIV is a master collection of them all. Zoe Blunt from the Forest Action Network, the late First Nations leader Kwatsinas, farmer from Earth First, critic John Zerzan, Paul Watson from Sea Shepherd, Dr. Michael Baker, Stephanie Mills, grid crasher Arctic McBay, and a long list of fast-moving video shorts from the underground. But the star of the show, the inspiration, is California author and philosopher Derek Jensen. Before we go to our interview with Franklin Lopez, let's get an introduction to Derek Jensen. You know my feelings about Derek Jensen are mixed. I could say I violently disagree with some of Derek's proposals, but then when Jensen uses the word violence, he really means it. He thinks Greens, anyone who cares about the Earth, should fight to stop the destruction of nature. We are beyond the time of talk, he says. Most famously, Jensen wants someone to blow up dams in the Pacific Northwest to save the beloved salmon. Picturing relatively green hydroelectric dams, I thought Jensen off base, if not dangerously mad. But digging deeper, Derek provides startling facts about thousands of useless dams built and abandoned by early loggers and settlers and corporations that continue to block many rivers. Governments have no workable plans to remove them, to restore the natural and valuable salmon fishery and the freedom of the rivers. The film NCIV goes further. Do we revere Gandhi because ruling oligarchs channel us into such peaceful protests? Were there other fighting figures behind India's independence struggle? Why don't we hear about them? Is Martin Luther King accepted while the Black Panthers are smeared because it suits authoritarian interests? What about Greenpeace? Have we been managed? What will we say to our children and grandchildren if we let Earth go down without a fight? I have my opinions on all this. You need to decide for yourself. As just one example of Derek Jensen's continuing influence, here is a quick clip from another director and filmmaker, John Cooksey, as an example of the impact Derek Jensen can have. I recorded this at a recent dinner party.
You know, there's an article that's really been sticking with me, and it was just an article. It was just an article about an interview with a guy named Derek Jensen, who you probably know, and I sort of knew his name. And what was interesting in that article was, you know, fairly reasonable guy, wasn't acting like a big gloomer doomer crazy person in the interview. Very reasonable, talking about statistics that you and I would both recognize about oil and whatever. And, you know, his basic point was that if there's going to be a habitat for the survivors, then we should monkey wrench the system right now. As much as we can, we should bring down civilization so that we don't overshoot the carrying capacity of the planet so much there's no habitat left for the survivors, whoever they may be.
He's right.
And he said that in full knowledge of the fact that if you monkey wrench the system, billions of people will starve to death in a short period of time. Like, that was obvious. That's taken as a given, right? And no guarantee that you and I and our children won't be part of that mass die from starvation, right? And that logic has haunted me. I can't pick a hole in the logic. Now, I know there's other criticisms of Derek Jensen or whatever, but the point is that he started from where we are, and he made a human emotional argument. It got me. And I'm the person who's constantly looking for the optimistic thing to root for, right, and to present as a path. And it troubled me, because it's like, wow, you know, is that the most realistic thing that I can root for? Why should I tell everybody just to go out and monkey wrench the system? Is that really the most realistic option that we have? Is to provide for the survivors, whoever they may be.
That was John Cooksey, a professional television producer, co-creator of the CBC series The Collectors, writer for diverse programs from the Disney Channel to Comedy Central. Now he has a one-man film about the journey to climate catastrophe called How to Boil a Frog. I recorded John at an evening of artists and activists in Vancouver. Hear more about that in next week's Radio EcoShock show. You can also find my short feature on Derek Jensen, produced in 2006. I said at that time, do we have to stamp out civilization to save the planet? The American author and activist Derek Jensen thinks so, and he offers his body to defeat the organized beast that is stripping the planet of forests, soil, and the species. There are three main reactions to the developing crisis here on Earth, whether you think of frightening climate change, raped ocean life, polluted slums, or just the economic unreality of the day. They are, let's fix it, let it fall, and finally the school of kick it over. Jensen is the prophet of slamming civilization, hoping it will fall before doing untold damage to nature. We'll hear from a recent speech, and we'll list some of the tenets of his belief, and add some books and web sources for further exploration. That was in 2006. Now it all looks worse. The U.S. Midwest is powered by toxic goo from the tar sands. The International Energy Agency admits peak oil has passed. The climate has gone mad, slamming millions. Derek Jensen is back. To introduce him for our feature film, NCIV, I'm going to run a quick summary of Derek's first eight premises, among many, in his own words, again from my 2006 podcast, Kick It Over. Get ready for a rapid-fire delivery of core beliefs which are startling, repulsive, and at times, just too true.
Okay, so the first premise of this book is that civilization is not and can never be sustainable. The second premise of the book is that traditional communities do not often voluntarily give up or sell the resources on which their communities are based until their communities have been destroyed. They also do not willingly allow their land bases to be damaged so that other resources, gold, oil, and so on, can be extracted. It follows that those who want the resources will do what they can to destroy traditional communities.
Those white men who've got the key to black man's identity in those lands, they're supposed to be forever.
The third premise. Our way of living is based on, requires, and will collapse very quickly without persistent and widespread violence.
What are we fighting for?
Okay, fourth premise of the book, and this is one of my favorite ones. This culture is based on a clearly defined and widely accepted, yet often unarticulated hierarchy. Violence done by those higher on the hierarchy to those lower is nearly always transparent, that is, unnoticed. When it is noticed, it's fully rationalized. Violence done by those lower on the hierarchy to those higher is unthinkable. And when it does occur, is met with shock, horror, and the fetishization of the victims.
Social conditions, no one will openly visit the atrocious revisions of our forefathers' decisions that cast a shadow like a desert oak.
Okay, fifth premise of the book. The property of those higher on the hierarchy is more valuable than the lives of those below. It is acceptable for those above to increase the amount of property they control, in everyday language, to make money, by destroying or taking the lives of those below. This is called production. If those below damage the property of those above may kill or otherwise destroy the lives of those below. This is called justice. Okay, sixth premise of the book. This culture is not redeemable. The culture will not undergo any sort of voluntary transformation to a sane and sustainable way of living if we don't put a halt to it. Civilization will continue to immiserate the vast majority of humans and to degrade the planet until it, civilization, and probably the planet, collapses. The effects of this degradation will continue to harm humans and non-humans for a very long time. Seventh premise. The longer we wait for civilization to crash, or the longer we wait before we ourselves bring it down, the messier will be the crash. And the worst things will be for those humans and non-humans who live during it and for those who come after.
Yeah. Now the rulers, they measure the indifference. Can you live with this history blistering like the PD opal images?
The eighth premise of the book. The needs of the natural world are more important than the needs of the economic system. I've just made it impossible for me to hold any public office. Another way to put the eighth premise is, any economic or social system that doesn't benefit the natural communities on which it is based is unsustainable, immoral, and really stupid. Sustainability, morality, and intelligence, as well as justice, requires the dismantling of any such economic or social system, or at the very least disallowing it from damaging your land base.
Listen close up to the hum of the land. Wheat belts kind of thirsty for some sustenance and the indelible scars from years of pastoralist hands.
For the rest of Derek Jensen's premises in rapid-fire order, just download the free MP3, Kick It Over, from ecoshock.org. Find the link in this week's show blog at ecoshock.info. By the way, those music clips in between are from a benefit to stop a Canadian mining project in Australia and the destruction of the ancient Lake Cowell, and it was performed by Combat Wombat.
Radio EcoShock.
Here's one more clip from the introduction of the new film, NCIV.
But it's statements like these that make him so controversial.
They're thinking of raising the Shasta Dam in California, and the reason that Senator Feinstein gave, was it is Californians' God-given right to water their lawns. You know, there is no way to argue with that, except with explosives.
That was Mr. Jensen in 2006, the same year he published a two-volume set called Endgame. In Endgame, he argues that there is an urgent need to bring down civilization.
If people would have brought down civilization 100 years ago, people in the Pacific Northwest could still eat salmon. There's going to be people sitting along the Columbia 50 years from now, and they'll be glowing, for one thing, but they'll be starving to death, and they'll be saying, I'm starving to death because you didn't take out the dams that killed salmon. And those dams were used for barging and for electricity, for aluminum smelters, for beer cans. So, God damn you.
He lays out his case against civilization by enumerating 20 premises. Due to time limitations and the fact that most people would not tolerate a 20-hour movie, we will explore 4 of these premises and accompany them with real-life examples.
Industrial civilization, civilization itself, but especially industrial civilization, is not and can never be sustainable. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that any way of life that's based on the use of non-renewable resources won't last. Civilization is a way of life characterized by the growth of cities.
So you've got groups of people living in a dense enough population that the local land base cannot support them. What that means is you have to get your basic resources from somewhere else because you've used them up where you live. So you're going to go out into the countryside and gather up whatever it is you want, bring it back in.
I think we are ready. Let's talk with filmmaker Franklin Lopez about his multimedia ode to a work by Derek Jensen called Endgame. This is Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock, and I'm glad to have a guest here in the studio. I've got Franklin Lopez. He was born in San Juan, Puerto Rico, but now he's based out of Vancouver, Canada. He's been doing what he calls culture jamming with various media. He's got, he worked with Democracy Now. What were you doing with Democracy Now, Frank?
I was a video producer, so it was basically all the visual elements of the show fell on the shoulders of the video producers. So I would cut video, shoot video, create graphics for the show, and also like help out with the show ideas and whatnot.
Well, this explains how you can come up with that podcast. It's like 10 or 12 minutes long usually, and it's called, what's it called?
It's called It's the End of the World as We Know It and I Feel Fine.
Right, and it's crammed with clips, and also you have original interviews that you've done with people that we'd never hear about in the mainstream media. You find them, and there they are. So you're obviously a cameraman, a producer, a video editor, and a troublemaker.
Oh, indeed.
A troublemaker. So, well, let's talk a little bit about your background. Why did you end up, do you think, becoming an activist, and how have you grown into that role?
Well, first and foremost, I need to honor my dad because my dad has been doing activism and political work in Puerto Rico to the benefit of the Puerto Rican people since he was 19. So he certainly helped me politicize myself. Although we don't agree on everything, he did show me the importance of giving a damn and actually doing things about it. And I can only hope to do as much as he did because he certainly was a pretty high achiever. But secondly, I think that political music was one of the ways in which I was able to sort of like bypass mental barriers of accepting certain ideas and looking at the world from a different perspective. And I credit Public Enemy for being a big gateway into the world of, in a way, alternative media, because in a way they were like they were almost like a radio station.
And it seems to me, following your career as I have to some degree, at least for the last few years, that you find the real action is important is what's happening behind the TV cameras. It's what's happening on the streets between people rather than the official functions the cameras are supposed to be looking at, all the guys in suits that arrive in limousines and hold conferences. Am I right there?
Yeah, absolutely. I think when you look at social change, social change is achieved on the streets. It's not achieved behind closed doors. Usually the people behind closed doors are buckling to some sort of a pressure that's being put by a mass of people who are doing stuff on the street. Well, you know, whether it be sittings, blockades, or, you know, even like confrontations with the police. People show their power in numbers, and those things take place in the cities and in the streets of the world. And I think that the mainstream media is not very interested in covering those things. But as these things get larger, as we're seeing like right now in Europe, for instance, it's very hard to ignore.
You went and covered the Republican convention back in the recent presidential elections and all of that. And you came away with film when other people were getting it taken away by the police. Would you care to share with us how you did that?
Yeah. I first also have to clarify, too, that I went to the Democratic convention, too, because I really wanted to show that it was important to oppose both parties, because both parties are culpable with the problems of America and the world and the United States as well. But in St. Paul for the Republican convention, we just developed a method of collecting video and putting it out there. And we basically had a secret location where video people like myself were basically doing a tape intake. So we had shooters out on the streets, we had runners, and then we had our location. So tapes would be run to us from our camera people on the street, and then it would land in my lap, and I would have to make something out of it. So even like the first day of the anti-Republican mobilizations, both my cameramen were arrested. We were able to get their tapes out before they actually went to jail.
You did a tour of the United States called Hopium. Tell us about that.
Yeah, mostly on the West Coast of the United States, but I also included Colorado in that. That was a multi-purpose tour. The main idea behind Hopium, you know, as I think it was Mao who said, religion is the opium of the people. I think hope, as Obama put it, is the opium of the people now. Obama sold this idea, pretty big words, hope and change, where people like myself who have been following the electoral process for some time know that that's, you know, those are basically empty promises. And my goal was to show people that Obama is an advertising dream. He's been manufactured by PR people and politicians as an Uber candidate who really serves the goals of the elites, of the power structure, of the bankers, of the big corporations, of the military-industrial complex. Every 4 years in the United States, people who fall within the center or a little bit left of the center sort of abandon their politics for that 1 year to basically throw all their energy and support towards a Democratic candidate, when we see the track record of both Republicans and Democrats is not much different. So what I was trying to do is basically burst everybody's bubble, which is basically one of the things that I like to do the most. While being on the road, having the tour fund the travel, I did the majority of the interviews I did for my film, NCIV.
Okay, well, let's get to that film, NCIV, and that stands for End Civilization?
End the Civilization, that's correct.
Talk to us about the basic premise of the film.
The basic premise is it just takes the ideas put forth by Derek Jensen in two books that he wrote called Endgame. He released these in 2006. One of the interesting things that he does in the books is instead of trying to lure the reader into these ideas, he comes up front and puts out the premises of the book. So the, you know from the get-go exactly what he's going to propose, what he's going to try to explain. And the very first premise is civilization is not and can never be sustainable. And this is particularly of industrial civilization. And so what I try to do in the film is take a few of the premises of his books and bring them to life. So, for example, there's a premise on this culture being an industrial civilization, being based on violence. I take that premise and I juxtapose our sort of Western way of life with gadgets, with diamonds, with instant on electricity, and I show where those items or that energy or whatnot comes from. So I have a light switch, and on the other side I have an explosion going off at an open pit mine of coal, right, for instance, just to show that for us to have this awesome electricity that we are so attached to, mountains have to be destroyed.
The concept of civilization being the problem, it's not a new one in deep green thought. And I just interviewed a fellow named Dr. Tim Garrett, who's worked out an actual formula in physics showing that the more wealth you have, the worse the environment's going to be and the worse the climate's going to be. And that's how it is. So you either shrink your wealth or you lose the environment. Is that still on track with what your film and what Derek Jensen is saying?
Yeah, I think it's another way of arriving at the same conclusion. I didn't really do this in the film, and when you look at critiques of civilization, everything goes back to domestication, specifically domestication of wheat, i.e., agriculture. And I think that's at that point where things started going awry. That's when you started to have population growth, but also that's when you started having slavery. That's when you started having a division of labor. That's when you started having hierarchies of work. And I think a lot of our problems, you know, when people look at my film, especially anti-capitalists or anarchists or communists or socialists or whatnot, they point out that I don't use the word capitalism a whole lot in my film. And they say, well, capitalism is the problem. And I say, yeah, well, capitalism is a problem, but capitalism is born out of civilization. So when we are looking at problems and we want to get rid of ourselves of problems, we have to look at the root. Otherwise, everything is just Band-Aids, right? So civilization is at the core of the problems that we're facing today. And we need to basically go deep into why things devolve in such a bad way. So it's a long history there, and I obviously don't have the time to put all out there. But just as I explained, agriculture was essentially the domestication of the land. And from there on, we just kept domesticating and also appropriating things that as men or as a human that are ours, that we, as one of the people in my film, we made ourselves masters of creation. And that gave us ownership and gave us permission to destroy, plunder, and loot.
There are still a few Aboriginal people living off the earth sustainably, and some people think that they can give us some leadership. Do you talk about Aboriginal people in your film?
Yeah, they're very prominent in my film. As an anarchist, I am often asked to imagine or to exemplify how anarchism will work, you know, being a system without huge hierarchies, without the big centralized power that we see in the world right now. And the world I envision is a world without hierarchies and a world in which people live sustainably and respect the land and respect each other, respect gender, respect people with different lifestyles. And Aboriginal people, and the examples I use are the ones from North America, live sustainably in North America for over 10,000 years. And to a large degree, many of them have very egalitarian societies, very little conflict, not a whole lot of war. A lot of them never really experienced famish, never really knew what something like going hungry was like. When people want to look at things that have worked, especially here in North America, we don't have to go that far. You know, these folks have tremendous oral traditions, and you can see how quickly civilization, once it arrived here, has destroyed the land. So I think it's not just important, it's imperative that we look at how indigenous peoples have lived and how they have, quote unquote, managed, even though I don't like to use that word, nature, and try to see if we can figure out a way to apply those things to our current situation. I understand that everything's been scaled up just because of, again, population growth, and that we might not be ready to just give up on agriculture, but there's got to be a different way. And indigenous people would certainly be amazingly helpful in showing us the way to a more sustainable future.